You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
I must share another story with you. And this is a story that I feel almost a duty to inflict on every acquaintance of mine, because I just think it's so powerful for me. And I hope it makes sense to the listeners here.
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Membership at DevOps Institute. Welcome back to another episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. It's great to have you back for another episode as a listener, and I'm really excited today to have on Avinash Rao, VP of Products at Digite, as of 1 month ago. So congratulations to you, Avinash, on your new position. Avinash, welcome to the podcast. Avinash is a Blackbot certified master product management professional with deep expertise in DevOps and lean agile transformation. He is a DOI ambassador, thought leader. You speak all over industry forums with deep expertise in achieving enterprise agility. And your career has taken you around the globe to the UK, the United States, Japan, and you currently reside in Bangalore, India. So Avinash, with all that said, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, Jason. I have got a chance to listen to the first two podcasts and I thought they were brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm very pleased to be and very excited to be here.
Thank you so much. And I'm a big fan of yours. I had some opportunity to check out your LinkedIn and also learn a bit about you. And you know, as you know, then from listening, we're going to get personal. We're going to get into it. And it's all about the human. We want to know all about you and why or how you've made some decisions in career that led you to where you are today. And so why don't we just kick it off by maybe you could give us like a brief overview of kind of your background.
Sure. So I've been in the industry for about 22 years now. And I started out from college with one of the large multinational software services companies. I thought at that time that technology was the coolest thing that was that I could ever do. And I thought that the world's problems could be solved with technology. And so about 2 years of being a Java developer, the organization that I was working with, they were growing extremely rapidly. When I joined, there were about 2,000 people. I think 5 years later, there were 70,000 people. So there was this huge work going on the services supply chain area. How do you match the number of people coming in versus the demand? And how do you not maintain a huge bench? How do you not have clients wait endlessly for getting the right people? And I thought it was a fairly straightforward problem, right? I mean, how hard could it be? And so all it was, you write the right kind of code, you use the right algorithms, and we can fix it. So I went up to the lady who used to run business operations for the company in India. And I told her she had such a terrible team. If only she had someone like me on her team, I would have fixed that in about 3 months. So she looked at me for a long time. And then she said, Avinash, you know what? Leave technology, come work for me. I'll give you 6 months. Let's see if you can help me solve this problem. So I moved out of doing programming to a business analyst role, where I was looking at large amounts of essentially data matching, saying, how do you do optimization across multiple variables? And I did that for a bit. And then I realized, or I started realizing, that not everything is a finite determinate problem and can be solved with code. As my wife found out, much to her eternal regret, I suspect. The first time she said, Avinash, you're not spending enough time with me. And I said, wait, what is enough time? How do we define enough time? What's the benchmark?
Oh, God. Did she slap you after that? Because I don't know if that would go over very well for me.
No, I assure you, don't try it at home, folks. You know, the warning that they give for stunts, and this is one stunt you should not try. I definitely don't recommend it. But I started out being a very very determinate sort of a person, but I thought that you could solve every problem with logic and with reason. And what I've realized over time is that a lot of the problems that we are faced with in the IT industry that we work in that are multivariate. You just can't hold one little string and then say, I'm going to keep pulling it till I solve the whole problem.
Yeah, there's a great saying, common sense isn't very common. And I sometimes, yeah. I think I can apply that with, when you take logic and you're like, well, that makes sense. But what makes sense typically isn't what people do, right? we're all flawed. And I think that's what makes us human. And I think that's what's so great about DevOps I'm learning is, you take something technically perfect, but it's not, because you have to apply it to imperfect people.
Absolutely. I'll give you a story, as you probably realize by now that I'm fond of stories. By the way, just as an aside, I have written a few plays which have been performed on various stages in Bangalore. So I'm a bit of a story person.
You're a playwright?
Yes.
Oh, I've very written, cool.
Yeah, I have four performed plays.
Oh, very great. That's awesome.
It's something that, keeps me fresh in the weekends. And you come back on Monday morning and it's a whole new perspective to things because you've been thinking about something else absolutely in the weekends.
That's great.
One of the formative incidents that I think has stayed with me over time is, and that showed me the limitations of some of the approaches that we often take, is it's my first project as a lead consultant. And I was in the middle of the cornfields in Peoria, Illinois. And I was working for a major manufacturing group there, consulting with them. And I had written this bit of code that cut down cycle time by 70%, et cetera, all that cool stuff. And I was feeling really proud of myself. And so my boss set up a meeting with the VP, the client VP. And I spent 15 minutes showing him a lot of graphs. This is all the cool work that we've done. And the gentleman, a rather serious gentleman, turns to his finance person who was also in the meeting. And he says, Jim, did our profits go up because of everything that Avinash has done? And Jim says, no. And then he says, the VP says, Jim, did my costs come down or my revenues go up because of what Avinash has done? Jim again says, no. So then the VP turned to me and said something that I'll never forget. He said, look, you may do all this great work, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't show end to end and my revenues don't go up and my profits don't go up or my costs don't come down, then what have you really done? You've created this little local optima, and I'm not knocking what you've done, Avinash, that's fine. But you've created this local optima that really isn't giving the kind of business value that that would really make a difference. And that I can hear the guy's voice in my head after, I think this was about 18 years ago. And that's just something that that I think about a lot, saying, what results are the improvements that we are making? What does it really mean in terms of improving it from an end-to-end perspective?
So how did you apply that 18 years post now? What have you taken from that?
So it's been an interesting journey. I don't think we'll ever get to a destination. I think the interesting bit, because we iterate and improve almost on an ongoing basis. So agile, I thought for a long time, was the answer to a lot of the prayers that we have in the industry, because you'd look at that and say, hey, inspect and adapt, and then empower teams and people. And I've been using agile for about 14 years now. And in those 14 years, I've seen all the good that it has done, but we've also taken a lot of that good for granted now. We want better. Nobody now benchmarks against the projects which used to run for years and then nothing used to come out and get scrapped and all that. We so used to a continuous delivery of software that we're now saying, you know, what's the value? How can we improve it? So I think we're getting better and better on the art as well as the science of creating software. And for me, that's the most fascinating thing that there is. I must share another story with you. And this is a story that I feel almost a duty to inflict on every acquaintance of mine, because I just think it is so powerful for me. And I hope it makes sense to the listeners here.
Are you looking to get DevOps certified? Demonstrate your DevOps knowledge and advance your career with a certification from DevOps Institute. Get certified in DevOps Leader, SRE, or DevSecOps, just to name a few. Learn anywhere, anytime. The choice is yours. Choose to get certified through our vast partner network, self-study programs, or our new SkillUp e-learning videos. The exams are developed in collaboration with industry thought leaders and subject matter experts in the DevOps space. Learn more at devopsinstitute.com/certifications.
So I used to live in London, where I was program managing a large agile program. And there was this neighborhood class which was teaching Taekwondo. And I wanted my daughter to learn. My daughter was about 4.5 at that time. And so my daughter goes there. She looks around and says, yeah, seems okay. And she says, I'll join if daddy joins. So daddy decides that he's going to be a good dad and signs up as well. And there are just two people in a class of about 20 odd folks who are above the age of 30. There's me, and there is this gentleman who's about 35, 36. He works with motorcycles. He's got a blonde ponytail. He's got skull tattoos on his bulging biceps, and he has a Harley parked outside. The instructor, of course, says, you two oldies — he didn't say oldies, he was very nice — but he said, you two oldies, we're going to pair you up because everyone else is in school or college. And this gentleman is going to grab Avinash by the throat. And in 5 minutes, Avinash is going to throw his opponent on the floor. Five extremely painful minutes later, because I couldn't move the guy, release myself and throw him on the floor, the instructor comes by and says, Avinash, this is not a hard work problem. Even if you pumped iron and took steroids and worked out for a year, your opponent probably still would be stronger than you are, right? This is a technique problem. There are spots on the arm where there are no muscles, so it doesn't matter how strong your opponent is. You need to pinch, twist, and trip. And by the end of the first class, if my opponent did grab me by the neck, I was able to free myself and throw him down on the floor. So that is a metaphor that I think I apply to almost everything. When I look at people working very hard to solve problems, to improve, and I think, is this a hard work problem? Do you want a 5% improvement, a 10% improvement? Then hard work will probably do it. But if you want a transformation, an order of magnitude improvement in how things are, and you want new capabilities, then I think it can't be a hard work problem anymore. You must look for the right techniques that you must master and then apply to the problem. Otherwise, there's no way you're going to get 30% better just by working nights.
Yeah, I love the Taekwondo analogy. And something you said resonated a little bit with me about we never know where we're going on our journey, and we've never really completed it because until you have completed it. But also with your career, I mean, I actually had early in my career, I was lucky enough to have someone very bluntly tell me how it was, where I had been given a lot of responsibility and I was exhausted. And I literally said to my boss, it feels like I never have a down day. And he said, well, if you did, you wouldn't be employed. So you know what, that really hit home, and I carry that because, you know what, he's right. So I've never complained about to being too busy, because if you're busy, then you're employed. So there you go. And then something else you said with the Taekwondo. So I want to learn more about Taekwondo. I want to know, you know, so how long have you been practicing now?
So I did practice for 4 years actively. Mm-hmm. So I did win a silver medal at one of the events as well, but that wasn't in combat. It was a forms demonstration of how you do the Taekwondo forms. But I think I've always continued to do some martial art. I've now switched in recent years to Tai Chi, which is a less high impact, more meditative form, really. But as my instructor tells me, that is really the foundation for other schools of martial arts like Kung Fu. But yeah. It's something that there's something in that art that really calls to me in terms of the, not just the discipline, but in also, there's almost a beauty in its regular practice. And then just like many, many other things in life, you start reading from a cookbook and you throw in this particular amount of spices, throw in this rice. I don't know if you've been to India often, but we are very, very particular about our food here. So everything has to be just so. When you start cooking from a recipe book, it never is the way that it should be because you're following instructions. But you do that over time, and then if you think of Miyagi's,
the wax on, wax off.
The wax on, yes. Wax off. Yes, that's exactly what it's looking for. Wax on, wax off, and then you're putting the same spices, the same rice, the same flour, etc. But over time, you get to magic. I think a lot of things, even DevOps. There's just so many people who look at DevOps and say, "Yeah, we bought Jenkins, we're DevOps." No, you aren't. You're reading off a recipe book, right? And then you keep doing it over time, going in the right direction. And that's where the magic happens.
Yeah, as a kid of the early 80s, coming to age in the 90s, you're speaking to me, my language, martial arts. I think everything back then, right? The Karate Kid. And, I was a huge fan of the Ninja Turtles. And yeah. I had a Ninja Turtle in my apartment complex. This guy who lived upstairs from us used to come downstairs and he had a real samurai sword, and he would take it into the atrium, and he would practice every Saturday morning. And my brother and I would just sit out there in awe of the movements that this guy was, and everything was flowing so smooth and very particular. And I mean, it's a true art form. And of course we were so into it because I mean, Michelangelo, Donatello and Raphael were like the coolest in the world to us. So
absolutely. I'm still a sucker for all the martial arts movies that come out. Yeah. In recent years, though, I've done a fair amount of long distance high altitude trekking. So I was actually at Everest Base Camp.
Wow.
A few months before the whole lockdown and the pandemic hit.
Wow, that's amazing. So, I mean, I've gone to some higher areas, but nothing like, I mean, I think I was at the highest was like 12,000 feet, and that was high. That was enough. That was like you get a nosebleed or your cell phone dies. But base camp of Everest, what is that? That's
18,000.
18,000?
Yes.
Yeah, that's high. That's very high. Was it hard to breathe up there?
Not particularly. I think we made sure that we acclimatized as we went in. But mm-hmm. I think the constant cold just sucks the energy out of you. So it's not only the breathing, it's also your muscles need rest what seemed like after every few steps. But
how hard is it to get to base camp? Because I know I've seen the movies, you know, I read the book, the books about, you know, the what happened on the mountain in the 90s and stuff like that when it was really booming. But yes. How hard is it?
Base camp is okay because that's where trekking or hiking stops and then it becomes mountaineering. So you need to actually know how to use a pickaxe and use ropes and things like that. You don't need that for base camp.
Okay.
So you can actually get there if you're determined to walk 120 kilometers with a 10 kg bag, mm-hmm. then you can go in and come out.
Wow. So you don't need like a guide, a Sherpa for base camp?
We did have a guide to take us in. But I think people do go in by themselves.
Oh, man. So, were you
our group did decide that it would help because they would know the right places to stay in the villages along the way.
Right.
And it was just a little bit easier that way.
Is that something you're looking to do? Like, are you trying to go to other peaks, or well, not peaks, but trying to, or maybe you want to go to a peak? I don't know. Is that something you're striving for?
So that was my, I think my fifth high altitude, long distance trekking in the Himalayas. So obviously I've been to 17,000 times, 15,000 once, things like that. I'm definitely looking forward to it once this whole pandemic is out of the way.
Yeah. I think we're all ready for this pandemic to be out of the way so we can start doing things.
Absolutely.
Well, how are things in India right now? Speaking of the pandemic, you brought it up, and I know just from what I hear on the news, but how is it going near you?
So I think things are slowly getting better. Things were, I think, fairly terrifying for a lot of us. And in a way, I feel that we in the IT industry are a relatively privileged lot. We are able to work from home pretty much seamlessly. We have our machines, our connectivity. Everything is online. We order all our vegetables, fruits online. We then bring it in and then keep it for 4 hours or whatever the prescribed time frame is. And then we wash it with all kinds of soaps and detergents, food grade, of course. But if you really think about that, that's an incredibly privileged place to be in India. I have got my first vaccination shot, but that was because I have access to computing, I have access to high-speed internet, and the way to do the booking for the vaccinations, for example, is all online. But I think the larger thing that I constantly think about is what happens to the multitude of people in a place like India that really don't have access to high-speed networks or computing. What happens then? And those are also people in jobs which can't be done remotely. So that's where I think things are very, very tough.
Yeah, I hope it starts turning around. Obviously, in the United States, within the past couple months, really the past month, it's gotten drastically better. It was not doing well here, for a while there. But luckily things have gotten better. I hope that India is going to have a quick turnaround. The vaccination certainly helped. I know you said you guys are on lockdown, right? Is that across India right now?
Not across India. Bangalore and Karnataka, the state that in the southern part of India that Bangalore is in, is under full lockdown.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps. And how has it impacted business?
Again, I think if you look at it purely from an IT industry perspective, there's been a relatively lower impact because I think what we have done is that we've figured out a way to connect, get work done remotely, in a sense. But I see a huge difference between the first wave and the second wave, right? Because the first wave, there were just so many conferences that I went to and people said, remote working is here to stay because productivity is going up. Because the number of cases weren't that many, at least from an India perspective or a Bangalore perspective. But the second wave, I think, is just something where literally all of us have had friends, relatives who've fallen ill and struggled a little bit in this part of the pandemic, and that's just bringing the whole energy of the social ecosystem down. So I doubt if I'll be going to a conference and hearing that hey, second wave of the pandemic, productivity is actually up. I'd be very surprised.
Yeah. I think it was. I think when it hit in India as hard as it hit, I think everybody felt it across the world in a sense of, here we are, we think we're hopefully on the tail end, and then it just got so much worse so fast. I think everybody's trying to keep positive, here in the United States, but cautiously. I think I read in the New York Times, they were like, when do you know you're out of a pandemic? And they're like, well, you don't. It just kind of gradually happens. And, yes. Here we've had, I think 60% vaccinated at this point, which is tremendous. That's pretty cool. Tremendous. Yes. New Jersey, where I am in, is one of the better states for it. We were one of the last to lift our mask mandates. And you still see everybody wearing a mask because everybody's hesitating. Yes. You know, there's so much hesitation because they just don't want to relive it. But at the same time, I think everybody's excited to start getting back, and you're slowly starting to see more, you know, changes with how people behave and getting together with family again, because I mean, it's hard to put your life on hold for so long. It's just unnatural. So it's hopefully.
And I have friends and relatives in the US, and some of them were even planning outings for Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. And it's been a while since people have done that with a high degree of confidence.
Yeah, for sure. So for the future, I know it's hard to look at the future when you're, you know, kind of in the position where you're in. But what do you see the future of DevOps? What do you see are some of the challenges, and what excites you?
So I think what happened with the whole agile journey is that we transformed the process of the way we develop software. But what didn't happen is an engineering transformation. That there's really the process of developing software, and there is the engineering of it, the mechanics of it. I kind of tend to think about it as efficiency problems and effectiveness problems. If you're going to go to your product owner at the end of every 2 weeks and then say, hey, this is what we developed. How good is it? Is it fit for purpose? Things like that, right? So that really gives you feedback on how effective you are in developing the right thing. But it doesn't tell you anything about how efficient you were in the process of developing it, because you may have really struggled, and I know so many teams that many want to fall inside that 2 weeks. There was actually this very good friend of mine who was a QA lead, and he used to take his wife out to dinner and movie. This was pre-pandemic, of course. Dinner and movie the Wednesday, the second week of the sprint, because he then told his wife that, look, Thursday and Friday, everybody's going to dump their code in. As the QA lead, all hell is going to break loose. So I'm not going to be speaking much to you the next 2 days. So let's enjoy our Wednesday evening together. And I think that's just terrible. And that's what DevOps has done such a fantastic job of addressing, saying as soon as you have a reasonable amount of code that can be independently verified, deployed, go ahead and do that. Obviously, the tooling for DevOps, I think, is a relatively solved problem. The practices are getting there. I just know so many teams where people still check in after a week of DevOps. So there are so many practices that still have to catch up. But the good thing is there's recognition that those practices need to catch up. And that's good enough. We'll get there in time. I think the only change that I desire, and I think it's going to happen in the DevOps world, is the ability for us to communicate to the larger world outside the DevOps ecosystem what's really happening. Even DOI, I know many people are involved in the VSM consortium. There's just this huge amount of interest in value stream management, because we all recognize that, like the VP in Peoria, that at the end of the day, we must make improvements that result in clearly defined business value. I think in DevOps, we are very good at engineering metrics, but we haven't got to a stage of maturity where we are able to apply that in a value stream management manner and then be able to talk to the business about the value that DevOps is delivering. I think that is going to be the next big thing. I know several executives who are struggling, IT executives who are struggling. They know DevOps is cool. They know that teams have done a great job, but how does that translate into the discussions that they are having with, let's say, the CFO organization? That's where I see DevOps going. Does that make any sense at all?
It does make sense. I think everybody struggles with the value proposition, no matter where you're at, right? That's the hardest thing to do, is the value proposition. I've made a personal living on it, is how do you deliver value when you're in trying to sell a membership, for example, or you know, a community is really what we're building here at DOI. How do you what is the value, right? Everybody wants to know, what's in it for me? Right, DevOps makes a lot of sense. What's in it for me? You know, that's basically what you're trying to do, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean,
what I think of as the, if you think about it from a people, process, tools perspective, I think from a tools perspective, we're all sorted, practices will get there. People see the value, but are still asking the question, what's in it for me? Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to answer that. I don't think there's getting away from that at all. In my mind, though, there's another element, which is the politics of it. And I don't mean politics in a negative manner at all. Politics is the art of the positive, right?
This is so bad that politics became a bad word.
Yes, I know.
It's really not.
Yeah, to be able to, there used to be a time, I think about 10 years ago, when saying I have excellent political skills would have been seen as a good thing. But now I think it's just career limiting. Yeah. So the politics in terms of being able to work with the larger organizational ecosystem, being able to speak with them, to be able to negotiate with them, that's where I think we will see a huge amount of development.
Thank you so much for sharing with us and giving us a good sense of who you are as a person. You know, that's what we're all about, is learning about the human behind, you know, what the great career that you've had. So thank you so much for joining us, Avinash.
Absolute pleasure. And I think transformations are always built on personal credibility, that you have teams telling teams that, that you know, DevOps works. That's why another team adopts DevOps, not because the management decides that DevOps works, right? Credibility is always usually at a peer level, at trusted people telling you. And I think that's really the essence of transformation. So it's absolute fun being on the podcast. I was really excited about it, and I can't imagine how 45 minutes went by just like that.
It goes by so fast, doesn't it? I feel like we need another. And we're all on that path of transformation. That's what's so exciting about DevOps. So you're constantly transforming. So thank you again. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this episode the same way that I always do, encouraging you to become a premium member of DevOps Institute to get access to even more great resources just like this one. And until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human, live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.